It is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins. Game over! Bronco wins it!
He got it! He pulled it right out of the bushes!
Swing and a miss! He got him! And Aaron Nola leads two.
Swing and a miss! Struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 278. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Coming up, a fun episode here for you as the Phillies take 2 out of 3 from the Mets. We'll talk about the good from the series, the bad from the series, the... well, hell, I'm just not sure from the series, and I've got a great interview coming up with a terrific actress and a baseball expert. Ellen Adair is going to join the podcast for the first time. We'll talk to Ellen about the Phillies and about her love of the game and some of the different projects that she's got coming up, too. So we'll get into all that here in just a few minutes. Also, the worst-kept secret in Philadelphia was finally made public earlier this week. We'll get into all of that. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But before we get into the guts of the show, just a reminder, everybody, to please leave a 5-star rating and a review at Apple Podcasts when you subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed. If you already subscribe and haven't done that yet, and you wouldn't mind doing so, please go ahead and take care of that. That does help other Phillies fans find the podcast. And if you like bonus content, and really, you know, who doesn't like bonus content, go over to patreon.com/hittinseason and become a member of the Hittin' Season Patreon, where we have tons of bonus stuff there. Just sign up on that $5 a month tier, and you will get a ton of extra stuff from myself, from Justin Clue, Liz Rocher, Dr. Trevor Strunk. We've got video stuff on there, extra podcasts, written content. It's all there at the Hittin' Season Patreon. Again, just go to patreon.com/hittinseason. And again, tell a friend about the podcast. If you have a Phillies fan friend and they don't listen to this podcast, educate them on the Good Fight podcast feed, Hittin' Season, continued success, the dirty inning, the whole lot of it. All right, well, let's get into this Phillies-Mets series. And, you know, this Mets team is a real pain in the ass. I'm just going to come out and say it, man. It has been a struggle to play this team over the last, really, 7 years. The last time the Phillies finished a season with a winning record against the New York Mets was 2011, the 102-win team. But the Phillies got off to a good start here in 2019 by taking 2 out of 3 from the Mets at Citizens Bank Park, a team they went 8-11 against last year and just 5-5 at home. They are 11-6. This season. That's the first time they've had that record since 2011. They have the best record in the National League with the Milwaukee Brewers' loss on Wednesday, and their run differential as of the end of their game on Wednesday is plus 17. That is second in the National League, only to the Dodgers, plus 29. And so we're going to break this down into some of the good that we saw this week, some of the bad that we saw this week, and some of the stuff we saw this week that I don't know that we can really categorize just yet. And we're going to start off with the good. Why start off negative? Let's do the good news first. And I think the best news that came out of this week is seeing Jake Arrieta pitch the way that he pitched on Wednesday. A phenomenal performance in the 3-2 win over the Mets. He was in ace form. This was the guy who was so good for the Chicago Cubs in 2015 and 16. His stuff was dancing all over the place. Mets hitters just with one weak ground ball after another, over and over again, they could not square him up. Light years different from the Jake Arrieta we saw last year. He went 8 innings in this one, gave up 6 hits, 2 runs, lowered his ERA to 2.25 on the season. He came out to start the 9th inning. Gabe Kapler tried to let him go for the complete game, but after an infield single, actually it was a relatively well-hit ball that glanced off him, Gabe Kapler went out and got him, and Adam Morgan and Hector Neris, in nerve-wracking fashion, finished off the 3-2 win. But this was the first time ever that Gabe Kapler has let a pitcher start the 9th inning, and he wanted to give Jake Arrieta that opportunity. That's one of the things I think we have seen from Gabe Kapler during his time as a Phillies manager, even going back to last year. After the mistake he made on opening day last year with Aaron Nola, he has tried to give his veteran starting pitchers with a track record like Nola and Arrieta the benefit of the doubt, the opportunity to finish what they start, to let them go a little bit longer than the analytics might dictate. But I thought Kapler handled it perfectly. That was what I was saying on Twitter, was let Jake Arrieta come out for the 9th inning, but if somebody gets on, you go to the bullpen. don't get to the point where Jake Arrieta is facing the tying run at the plate. And that's what he did. Gabe Kapler went out and got Jake Arrieta. Arrieta went eight strong, gave up just six hits, two runs, as I mentioned a minute ago. Four of those hits were infield singles. He and Mike Minor of the Texas Rangers are the only pitchers in baseball to pitch seven or more innings in three of their starts this year. And he has made he has pitched seven or more innings in three straight starts, Jake Arrieta has. And I think it's pretty clear that Chris Young and Jake Arrieta have figured something out with his mechanics, because we've always known that for Arrieta to be successful, his mechanics have to be good. His release point has to be good. He's got to be coming over the top more than at a three-quarter angle, because when he's coming at the three-quarter angle, his ball slides horizontally, and it's not as easy to control. Today, at least based on what I saw in the game, it seemed like his pitches had more vertical drop than horizontal drop, and Mets hitters just simply were baffled by it, and that's a really good hitting team. One of the things that I learned about the Mets this week is they may not have the superstar stud in Bryce Harper, but they have a ton of guys in that lineup that can beat you. Pete Alonso can beat you. Jeff McNeil can beat you. Michael Conforto can beat you. Ahmed Rosario can beat you. Wilson Ramos can beat you. There are so many bats in that lineup that can do damage against you, and Jake Arrieta handled it beautifully. And I think some of the work that he and Chris Young have done working on getting him to come a little bit more over the top in his delivery, if he can maintain that, if Arrieta can continue with that plane of a throwing motion, I think we're going to see a very good pitcher. He's got to do it for a longer time, but he said after his last start last week that he felt that he still had the ability to pitch at an elite level, and that is what we saw on Wednesday. We saw elite-level Jake Arrieta, and given the struggles that we've seen in the starting rotation from Aaron Nola and Nick Pivetta, both of whom we'll get to in just a minute, Jake Arrieta stepping up and doing what he did with a depleted bullpen on Wednesday ahead of a four-game series coming up in Colorado, it was monstrously huge for him to go eight innings for this team. So now the Phillies have a well-rested bullpen going into a four-game series against the Rockies in Colorado. That's a big deal. That is a big help, and Jake Arrieta looked every bit the $25 million a year pitcher on Wednesday against a very good hitting New York Mets team. Another good thing to come out of this week, Scott Kingery. Everybody's excited about Scotty Jetpacks now. After last year, which was just a dreadful season, a terrible rookie season for Kingery, I think most Phillies fans gave up on him. I was never one of them. I'll admit to you when I've given up on somebody. I had given up on Michael Franco. I'll be perfectly happy to admit that I had given up on Michael Franco, and I'm exceedingly happy to have been proven wrong on Franco. He has been amazing. But one guy, you saw how much talent he had in the minors. He was a top 30 prospect in baseball for a reason. The talent has always been there with Scott Kingery, but there were issues with his approach at the plate last year. Too many first ball fastballs right down the middle taken for strike one. And we know, the numbers bear it out, that hitters who start their counts 0-1, especially a guy who's naturally been aggressive like Kingery in his career, tend not to fare well. Kingery, when he's at his best, is attacking the ball early in counts. And that's what he's gotten back to this year. He had two home runs this week against the Mets. He's now batting .480, .536, .880 in 25 plate appearances this year. In his last four starts, he's 10 for 17 with four doubles, two home runs, and six RBIs. He currently has a Fangraphs wins above replacement of 0.8, which is the same as Bryce Harper so far, and Kingery has done it in 50 fewer plate appearances. That's stat from Devin Fink. He's swinging early in the count, being aggressive. It's all paying off for Kingery. And so the question is, how does he stay in the lineup? He's been a little bit fortunate in that the Phillies have dealt with some injuries here over the last couple of days. Gene Segura was not in the lineup for the game on Wednesday after he strained a hamstring in the game on Tuesday, but it doesn't appear to be a long-term injury, a terribly serious injury, so I think you will probably see Kingery get another start or two at shortstop, but the expectation is that Gene Segura will be back and ready to get back on the field, and so what do you do with Scott Kingery then? His bat is too hot to take out of the lineup, but you're also not going to sit him for Michael Franco. Michael Franco has been killing it. He had a couple of big hits in this series, including a monster three-run home run in the blowout win on Tuesday, which we're going to talk about in just a second. And in the game on Wednesday, Cesar Hernandez hit a long solo home run, had a few really good at-bats. He went 4-for-9 with 2 RBIs and 4 walks in the series against the Mets. So I think it's more likely that Kingery's playing time comes at the expense of Cesar Hernandez if Hernandez begins to struggle again. I do think second base is ultimately going to be where Kingery ends up, but at the moment, he's going to fill in for Gene Segura, and then after that, I think he's going to jump around. And we're seeing now this year that being the super utility guy, playing at shortstop like he did on Wednesday, playing a game at third base, playing a game at second base, and there was talk on Tuesday that they were going to have Kingery play center field, which is a position that he played in college a little bit, to give Odubel Herrera a rest, but that was also the same day that Gene Segura had to come out of the lineup, so they weren't able to do that. But they plan on using Kingery all over the field, and his bat is going to make it really hard for Gabe Kapler to take him out of the lineup. It's a good problem to have. Too many good players. It's not something that we've had to deal with in quite some time here in Philadelphia. One of the other good things, ambushing the Mets on Tuesday was cathartic. It was just cathartic. After that 24-4 drubbing that the Phillies had to endure at the hands of the Mets last year in the first game of that doubleheader in Philadelphia, their 14-3 win on Tuesday was just a little bit of payback. Obviously, they fell 10 runs short of matching the Mets' 24-run outburst, but it still felt good to put up 10 runs in the first inning on Steven Matz. And Steven Matz made a little bit of history in this game, by the way. He faced 8 bats. This is just, I mean, you feel bad, kind of bad for a guy. He was also done in by some bad defense, Steven Matz was, in the first inning on Tuesday. He should have been out of that inning with maybe no runs allowed. But anyway, he faced 8 batters in that first inning, got none of them out, and allowed all 8 to score. That is the 6th time in Major League Baseball history that a starting pitcher has allowed 8 or more runs without recording an out. And I'll have another stat regarding this game as our stat of the week, because there were a lot of good ones to come up. Whenever you have, that's the beauty of baseball, by the way. Can I just, with a quick tangent here, because there's no clock in baseball, you just get to keep playing until you make the requisite number of outs and you have to stop hitting. So you don't have situations in football where you can put up 56 points in the first quarter. You don't have a situation in basketball where you can put up 80 points in the first period. In baseball, you could put up 20 runs in the first inning if you wanted to. 10 runs in the first inning is exceedingly rare, especially if you're in the Phillies organization. And you look at that 10-run first inning. We remember just a couple of years ago when they scored 12 runs in the first inning against the Nationals in an April game back in 2017. They sent 16 batters to the plate in that inning. This inning on Tuesday, the first inning in which they scored 10 runs, didn't quite compare. They sent 14 batters to the plate, scored 10 runs with 5 hits, all extra bases, 4 Mets errors in that first inning to go along with 2 walks and 1 hit by pitch. But both of those games fall short of that famous 1985 game in which the Phillies memorably crushed the Mets 26-7 on June 11th of 85. That was the game in which Von Hayes, one of my favorites, hit 2 home runs in the first inning. He was the leadoff guy that game. He led off the game with a solo home run and then came up to hit with the bases loaded still in the bottom of the first inning and did this.
Oh, here's another shot. Where's this going to wind up? Trying not to smile across the home plate, but what's he happy? Now he's letting it go. How about that for a start, huh?
Great call there by Andy Musser. I miss Andy Musser. At the time, I didn't. When Andy Musser was around and I was watching games as a kid, I never loved Andy Musser, but now hearing him as I'm an older guy, not an older guy, but in my early 40s and remembering those mid to late 80s games, I miss Andy Musser. I miss Chris Wheeler. I miss all those guys. And what's amazing about that 26-7 game, by the way, is that those were the only 2 homers hit in the entire game for the Phillies. They scored 26 runs in that game. And they had, what was it? I think they had 27 hits, but they only scored two of those 26 runs via the home run. Now, again, Von Hayes hit a solo homer and a grand slam, so five runs scored via the home run, but only two home runs accounted for those 26 homers. They scored nine runs in the first that day, seven in the second, five more in the fifth, one in the sixth, and four in the seventh. 27 hits. That's how much they had. 26 runs on 27 hits that day. Poor Tom Gorman got one out in that game, then turned it over to Calvin Schiraldi. Schiraldi gave up 10 earned runs in relief, and then Joe Sambito later in the game gave up another 10, although only eight of those were earned. So that was some of the good that came out of this week in the Philly series against the Mets. Some of the not so good, obviously the demotion of Nick Pivetta was a big topic of conversation on Wednesday morning because it surprised the hell out of everybody. Even though they won the game on Tuesday night in a blowout, Nick Pivetta's performance was disappointing. I mean, you got to go deeper than five innings when you get staked to a 10-0 lead in the first inning, but he just has not been able to get it together, and the Phillies decided that his performance was disappointing enough that he was sent down to AAA Lehigh Valley. I thought that he was going to have more of a leash. I certainly thought that he had a little bit more slack than four games, but one of the things the Phillies are telling you right now is that they are not playing around anymore. They have served notice to this entire roster that if you don't perform and there's somebody around who they think can do a better job, you're going to be gone. You're either going to go down to AAA, or they're going to trade you, or they're going to release you. This team wants to win right now, and they're not willing to throw games away here in April waiting for Nick Pivetta to get right. You know, we all talked about this breakout season from Nick Pivetta. It hasn't even come close to happening. I was surprised the leash was this short. I thought it would be a bit longer, but it's hard to argue with what they did. Pivetta has an 8.35 ERA this year, a 6.41 FIP in his four starts. His strikeout rate has fallen to 17.2%. It was 27.1% last year. Hitters are batting .369 against him this season. In the game on Tuesday, he allowed 10 base runners in five innings through 100 pitches with a bullpen that was in desperate need of a starting pitcher to step up and give them a lift. Pivetta just couldn't do it. He could not get through a very good New York lineup and needed to be pulled earlier than Gabe Kapler would have liked, and the Phillies just said, we're not doing this. We can't abide by this. And going down to AAA, I think, will help him. It helped Roy Halladay when he was a young pitcher, being sent down to the minors at the beginning of his career. The Indians did the same thing with Cliff Lee. I think it was the season before he won the Cy Young Award. The Phillies had to do it with Brett Myers during the 2008 season, and Brett Myers came back up. Even though Myers was out of options, he willingly took a demotion down to AAA to get himself back on track and came up and was a valuable member of the World Championship 2008 team. So this doesn't mean Nick Pivetta is gone forever. I still think Pivetta is going to return this year and be an effective and important part of this team, an effective and important part of the 2019 Phillies. Now, it might be in the bullpen. It might not be in the starting rotation. A lot of that's going to depend on how Jared Eichhoff does. Eichhoff was called up on Tuesday before the game to give the team some length out of the bullpen just in case Pivetta faltered, and that's exactly what happened. And Eichhoff came in and twirled four scoreless innings of relief, six strikeouts, three hits allowed, and no walks. He looked good. He doesn't throw as hard as Pivetta. He doesn't have the nasty fastball like Pivetta does. But the Pivetta we saw in spring training has not appeared in the regular season. He's not attacking hitters the way he did in the spring. His fastball velocity is not consistently as good. He's not commanding anything. He's simply a different guy, and he needs to go down to AAA and figure things out. We heard Gabe Kapler talking about Nick Pivetta on the podcast we did on Sunday, episode 277, talking about how he needs to be more prepared to start the game. And I think maybe we saw a little bit more intensity from Pivetta, but I think there's a lot going on between the ears with Pivetta that needs to be straightened out. And maybe being humbled a little bit by having to go down to AAA and get himself together will get him back on track. I fully expect Nick Pivetta to put up monster numbers in AAA, but in the meantime, I'm also really hoping that Jared Eichhoff is able to take advantage of this opportunity. You know that I used to call Jared Eichhoff the human metronome because he was so consistently good. Every start was basically the same. Six innings, two or three runs, 4 to 6 strikeouts. Sometimes he'd have a big strikeout game. He was just so consistent. And until he started dealing with the numbness in his fingers and in his hand, he was such a reliable part of this bullpen. A huge surprise in the return in the Cole Hamels trade. Nobody saw Eichhoff being that effective. And it would be fantastic. What a great story it would be if Eichhoff can be a major contributor to this 2019 Phillies team as a member of the starting rotation. Back to Pivetta for just another second. I think it would have been interesting to see if he would have gotten more rope had Aaron Nola not also been experiencing the type of issues that he's been experiencing. But the Phillies couldn't afford to have their number one and number two starters both performing like this. And that brings us to Aaron Nola. You know, we still can't really figure out what is going on with Aaron Nola. Aaron Nola is having all kinds of problems still. I mean, we're again, just 4 starts into the season, and his track record allows him to get a ton of rope. He, unlike Pivetta, is not in danger of losing his spot in the rotation. He is too important. But I'd be lying to you if I didn't say that Aaron Nola isn't a concern. He is a concern. There's no question about it. You have a 7.45 ERA in 4 starts, and you look as bad as he has looked in 3 of those 4 starts. You can't help but feel bad about where Aaron Nola is right now. He can't command anything. It's clear there's something mechanical going on with him. I mean, that much is obvious. And Chris Young said as much in that he thinks he and Nola may have discovered something the right-hander was doing, so they're optimistic that he's going to bounce back. And I am optimistic that Nola is going to bounce back as well. He's too good. And he's been too consistently good. Everybody swears there's no injury, that he feels great, that he feels healthy. If those things are true, if they're not blowing sunshine up our noses here, then I do believe Aaron Nola and Chris Young will help him, will figure a way out of this. But he's missing with all his pitches. I was looking at some heat maps on Fangraphs, and I'm going to do a piece on this for The Good Fight, I think, in the next couple of days. It's not that he's just missing a little bit. He's missing by a lot with everything. One of the things that makes Aaron Nola special is that when the ball is released from his hand, even if he's throwing a ball, you ordinarily don't know it until it's too late. But the issue with him has been with his fastball, with his changeup, and with his curve, especially the changeup and curve over the last couple of starts, it's been a ball right out of his hand, and hitters have been able to just spit on it. And that's why he hasn't been able to get ahead in the count. That's why his first pitch strike number is so much lower this year than it was last year. And let's also be fair that in the game on Monday night, it was ice cold. There was a 40-mile-an-hour wind going around. Noah Syndergaard struggled as well pitching in those conditions. The ball may have felt like a pool cue coming out of their hands, and that's largely the reason why, at least as far as Nola is concerned, he wasn't able to command the curveball and the changeup. But it has been a problem all season. I mean, Nola, this has been so unusual for him. Nola did not give up more than 4 runs in a game at all last year. He's already done it 3 times this season. But lest you think Aaron Nola is the only starting pitcher who's struggling this year, Corey Kluber has a 6.16 ERA. Zach Greinke is at 5.46. Syndergaard is at 5.63. Chris Sale has an ERA of 8.5. So we just have to hope that he gets himself out of this. And I do think the Phillies are not going to wait around forever for these starters to figure out what's going on. USA Today's Bob Nightingale reported that both the Mets and Phillies are showing a strong interest in Rangers ace, as Nightingale calls him, Mike Minor. Mike Minor is no ace, but he's probably the best pitcher in the starting rotation for the Rangers. Texas is undoubtedly making him available. He pitched a 3-hit complete game shutout against the Angels this week and has a 1.27 ERA in his last 3 starts. He's owed $9.5 million this year and next year. Overall this season, in 4 starts, he has a 2.60 ERA, a 3.94 FIP with a 21% strikeout rate. That's about the same as last year's when he wasn't terribly good last year. But he can be a reliever or a starter. He has that flexibility. And again, we've been talking about the Phillies could use a left-handed starter. Dallas Keuchel is still out there. And you might be asking yourself, why not just sign Dallas Keuchel and not give up anything? That's an excellent question. It really still depends on what Dallas Keuchel is looking for. Mike Minor, it remains to be seen how much of an upgrade he'd be. If what we're seeing from him early this season is going to be what we see all year, then yes, snap up Mike Minor right now. He looks fantastic at the moment. I'm just not 100% convinced it's going to last all season. Keuchel certainly has a better track record of being an effective starter, and the Phillies wouldn't have to give up any prospects in trade in order to get Keuchel, but they might have to sign him to a four-year deal, which they certainly seem hesitant to do. And now we move on to the not-so-sure stuff, and I move from the Mike Minor Dallas Keuchel stuff so we could talk a little bit about the bullpen and the possibility of bringing Craig Kimbrell aboard, because we know that the bullpen, while it's had a good week, I think still needs that ninth inning closer. I really feel like a good playoff baseball team cannot piecemeal the ninth inning all season long. Now, David Robertson's on the disabled list, but even when Robertson was available and healthy, he wasn't the automatic closer. But overall, the bullpen did have a good week this week, despite the high wire act we saw on Wednesday with Adam Morgan and Hector Neris almost blowing a 3-1 lead. They did get the job done. And on Sunday against the Marlins, they pitched 8 innings of shutout ball. They did have to see David Robertson hit the IL with elbow soreness, and that's a bummer. But they do have some arms back there to kind of fill the void. Tommy Hunter's now on the 60-day disabled list. Folks, I got to be honest with you. I haven't missed Tommy Hunter for one second. I'm sure Tommy Hunter is a nice guy and all, but I have not missed that inconsistency in any way, shape, or form. But we will miss David Robertson because it seemed like he was coming around. He's made at least 60 appearances each of the last 8 years, so I don't think the Phillies are going to go with one main closer. I think they're going to use different guys on different nights. And, you know, I think that the bullpen has a lot of swing and miss arms. We saw it in the game against Miami on Sunday. They were outstanding in relief of Aaron Nola on Monday. The pen gave up just 2 runs over 7 innings. Eichhoff pitched 4 innings of scoreless relief in the blowout. And then Morgan Neris pitching the ninth inning on Wednesday. Again, it was nail-biting, but they did end up getting the job done. Hector Neris and JT Realmuto did a great job with pitch sequencing on the last hitter of the game in order to get that final strikeout. But I still think if the cost of signing Craig Kimbrell is 3 years, $45 million, something like that, I'd do it. $15 million a season for Craig Kimbrell. If the Phillies had made that deal in December or January, I would have thought it was a steal. It's still a steal. I would still go get Craig Kimbrell at that kind of money. If that's what he's asking for, and that's what Ken Rosenthal reported last week, is he's looking for money in that range, I would certainly do it, and I'd give up the draft pick because, as we've seen with this team, they're done fooling around. They want to win this year, and every bullpen in the National League East needs help. In fact, the Braves just lost their closer, Aroldis Vizcaino, for the season. So they'd be stupid not to make a phone call and try and get their old teammate back on the Braves. Kimbrell to Atlanta just makes all the sense in the world. But, you know, I think that with the bullpen, I just want to know when that bullpen door swings open in the ninth inning, I want the comfort. And I think the team wants the comfort of knowing that somebody's going out there that they know has done it a million times, has been on the mound in big situations, in playoff games, and gotten the job done. I know he wasn't great with the Red Sox at the end of last year and in the postseason, but he's still relatively young. He's got a ton of talent. As we've said, relief pitchers are volatile. He may have just been going through a little bit of a stretch there. I would certainly bring Craig Kimbrell to the team at 3 years, $45 million, if that was something Kimbrell wanted. And I don't know what kind of conversations the Phillies have had. We've heard reports that they're only interested in a one-year deal. I still think this bullpen, despite having a good week, could really, really use that ninth-inning guy in Craig Kimbrell, just that established closer for a playoff team. That's something that makes everybody feel better. Well, coming up, I'm going to talk to a terrific actress and a big baseball fan, big Phillies fan, and someone who knows her stuff. We spoke on Tuesday night just as the 14-3 game was ending. So you'll hear us talk about Nick Pivetta a little bit. And obviously the news of the day dates those comments. But you can hear how prescient we were when we were talking about Pivetta and the time he had left in the rotation. So we're going to get into a terrific interview with the great Ellen Adair. That's up next right here on Hittin' Season. You may know her from USA's TV show The Sinner, also Showtime's Homeland and Billions, HBO's Veep, NBC's The Slap. Ellen Adair, terrific actress and a huge baseball fan, and more specifically and more importantly, a huge Phillies fan. We're going to talk some ball here. Ellen, thank you so much for coming on Hittin' Season. How are you?
Hey, it's really my pleasure, and I'm doing great because the Phillies are up on the Mets 14-3 right now. So
yeah, as we were... As we record this, the Phillies are shellacking the Mets, and it's beautiful. That 10-run first inning, and I know the Mets gave the Phillies a couple outs in that first inning, but it's always nice to see a team take advantage of gifts. You know, I like getting gifts. I figure most teams like gifts too. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it does. It does sort of feel a little bit like the ghosts of the Phillies 2018 defense have been like buried in the field and are sort of like reaching up to grab the ankles of the Mets fielders. But I'll take it.
Absolutely. You bet. And, you know, it's great for anybody who followed Ellen and on Twitter. And by the way, follow Ellen on Twitter at Ellen_Adair. And she also has a terrific Instagram as well. But for anybody who followed your social media presence during the Bryce Harper sweepstakes, Ellen, it's pretty clear to anybody who didn't know you before that you're a monster baseball fan. You know a ton about the game. And more specifically, like I mentioned just a second ago, that you're a big Phillies fan. But before we get into Phillies specific stuff, I was just kind of curious. I always wonder how people come to their love of baseball, because they say it's not a game that kids can embrace and all that. And I find that to be a lot of nonsense. But is this a game? Did you grow up loving baseball? Was it taught to you by your parents, or did you come to it later in life?
Yes, it was taught to me by my parents. And yes, that's total nonsense that kids can't love baseball, because I've loved baseball for as long as I can remember. And I've loved the Phillies for as long as I can remember. My parents were basically taking me to baseball games before I was pre-verbal. So for me, baseball is just really this, I don't know, like comfort zone for me. And Von Hayes was the first man that I ever loved. I got my mom to sew like a number 9 on my little toddler sized Phillies shirt, because of course these were the days before you could buy player specific jerseys for like your parakeet. And this is something that I know just by report, because I was too young to actually remember doing that, but started off a lifetime of forming particular attachments to baseball players.
So I was going to ask you, what was your first year of baseball awakening? Mine was like 1985, 1986, about the Von Hayes era, Mike Schmidt era, all those mid to late 80s teams that always seemed like they had some good players on it, but always underperformed those years at the Vet when things were just were always so terrible. What's the first team you remember following closely?
Well, I was so young at that time, so I loved them. But I don't remember, like, I don't remember my thoughts or feelings, except for that I love them. I can't say that I, you know, followed it. I wasn't into analytics at age like 3. so I don't know, like in some ways I feel like the like 1993 team, mm-hmm. you know, that yeah. pushed to the series was like sort of more formative for me, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was it. That was obviously a season where a lot of Philadelphia sports fans suddenly took notice that they had a baseball team again. It had been 10 years since they went to the World Series, and I was a senior in high school during that 1993 World Series team. So that got me at the perfect age. I mean, I still to this day remember just about every regular season game from that season, and that was the first time it occurred to me, because I'd watched every World Series since like the 85 World Series and always just dreamed of my baseball team being on national TV. And this was back in the day when, you know, they didn't have many national games on TV. You had like one game a week where you got to see a baseball team playing nationally, and the Phillies had never made the playoffs during the time when I was growing up watching them. So I just, when that finally happened in 93, that was still, I mean, it was just one of the coolest moments I can remember. It was like getting ready to watch the Braves in the championship series and thinking, my, the Phillies are actually in the playoffs. There's a blimp flying over Veterans Stadium. This is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of had a similar experience, but that's because I grew up without a television. So I listened to the games. That's how, you know, received the games. And so that's how I received them also. Playoffs, basically, we went over to neighbor's house that had a television because it was important. And I was like, that's what they look like. So I remember that. I mean, I sort of knew what they looked like from baseball cards. But yeah, that was big for me, too, because like I was playing softball at that point in my life. So it was they were real heroes to me.
Was that your favorite season, 93, or was it the 08 championship season? Do you have a favorite season? I mean, I have a hard time picking one favorite season myself, actually. But, you know, I think for me, it would probably be 2008 because I was only two or three when the 80 World Series happened. But, you know, I was just kind of curious. Some people, I think it's automatic. The championship team's their favorite season. But do you have a favorite season that sticks out?
Well, 2008 is hard to argue with. It might be my favorite season, but I actually have a soft spot in my heart for 2009, despite the way that it ended, and 2011,
yes,
because I love Cliff Lee. The whole rotation that year was the centerfold that I think Phillies fans still keep under their mattresses. But Cliff Lee in particular was just one of my favorite players of all time. He was just the king of the three pitch strikes. I still consider the day that he signed with the Phillies over the Yankees to be one of the best days of my life. I have the cover from the New York Daily News for that day on my refrigerator. It has been transferred from sort of three successive refrigerators during that time. So it's not like negligence that it's like very purposeful. It was like the ultimate story of good triumphing over evil for me, particularly after evil had triumphed so tragically over good in 2009.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, Merry Cliffmas. We all remember Merry Cliffmas.
Oh, Merry Cliffmas. Oh, it was so good. Yeah,
absolutely. And I agree with you about 2009. That Jimmy Rollins hit in the championship series is still one of the most electrifying. Might have been the most, outside of the Brad Lidge strikeout of Erkinski, the most electrifying moment of that whole playoff run. Because I'd never seen the Phillies win on a walk-off like that before. So, I mean, that was you're right. 2009 was a very, very special season, very underrated season to go back to the World Series. It kind of felt for a little while there like that team was just invincible. But I know the Phillies are not the only team that you follow. And you follow a lot of individual players. I think I had seen on one of your YouTube channels or something that you were at a game cheering on Eloy Jimenez, who's a really great-looking prospect for the White Sox. And I know when JT Realmuto was in Miami, you were a big fan of his. And so it's not just the Phillies. You have other teams that you follow kind of closely because you've kind of moved around the country when you were growing up, right?
Yes, that's right. I did. And so, you know, like when I... This is not why I was cheering for Eloy Jimenez, but, you know, when I was living in Indiana, for example, even though the Phillies were still my main love, I like had a poster of Frank Thomas on my door just because, like, Frank Thomas, of course.
Yeah.
The way that I consider it is that I have a complex flow chart of baseball allegiances. The Phillies are always at the top of that. The way that I sort of say it is that the Phillies are my life partner, but I really just enjoy rooting for baseball. And so I fall in love with players from all different kinds of teams, but I still want the Phillies to win. People can get kind of confused about that, but it's the way that I was raised. I wrote this article about my complex flowchart of baseball allegiances, and my dad sent me back not one, but two different letters very quickly, like in response, considering what his flowchart of baseball allegiances were and all of the teams that he also liked and why. And so, yeah, it's basically just like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah, it's serious business, though. I understand this. Absolutely. You're no doubt about it. So let's talk about the Phillies a little bit here, Ellen. I know you follow this team closely. You're obviously keeping track of what's going on with Aaron Nola this year. I think the starting rotation as a whole has really been a worry for this team in 2019. They're killing the ball as the game, you know, they've had some games where they got shut down by some pitching. But overall, for the most part, I think the Phillies offense has been about as expected, if not a little bit better than expected. It's clear that they're going to score some runs this year. But for me, the starting rotation has really been a worry, and chief among them, Aaron Nola. I mean, you look at, of all the pitchers in baseball that are qualified, that have enough qualified innings already, Nola has the highest ERA of any of them. And I think most people thought that he wasn't going to have as good a year as he had last year. Last year was a borderline historic season for a Phillies pitcher. I don't think any of us saw the kind of struggles that he's having now, where he just can't command anything. How concerned are you about Nola's start to the season?
I'm starting to get a little concerned. I say all of this with the proviso that Aaron Nola is like one of my five favorite people that I don't actually know. I am worried, and And there are a few reasons for that. First of all, I feel like when we've seen Nola struggle in the past, if we can cast our minds back, it's often been tied to an injury. And of course, right,
yeah.
But he's saying he's fine and he's healthy, including Aaron himself is saying the same thing. But from my recollection, if I'm casting my mind back, that is also what happened in the past, that they were like, he's fine. And then they were like, oh, just kidding, he's hurt.
Right.
So the other reason that I'm worried, or the second reason that I'm worried, is that this sort of tracks back to the end of last season when he suddenly would seem to just sort of be losing some of his dominance. And I remember talking to Michael Harris, who's the vice president of marketing for the Phillies and just one of the nicest people on the planet.
I've met Michael. He's a great guy. Absolutely.
Also, he's the best. And he was like, his starts haven't been as good ever since we started the Nola's French Quarter section, which just sad, but like tickled me as exactly the kind of quantum physics change in particle observation and magical thinking that I think all sports fans do, except for here was the marketing director version of that. Anyway, I've just thought about that every time that I don my Nola's French Quarter t-shirt. But my thought at the time was like, well, but Nola's just tiring. You know, like he ended up pitching 212 innings. That was more than he'd ever pitched. So he's just getting tired. But if you go back and look at those starts where he struggled last year, one thing that jumps out was that he wasn't throwing his changeup as much. Mm. And this year, he also hasn't been throwing his changeup as much. Last year, it was a total of 20%, and this year's total is 13%. But if you go back and look at some of his most dominant starts last year, it was like 25% changeups.
Right.
And this is one of my favorite factoids about Aaron Nola's glorious pitching mix that I'm sure you know, but maybe not everybody who has just followed his evolution in the majors might know, is that the changeup was actually such a strong pitch for him coming out into LSU that his coaches were like, that pitch is awesome. Let's work on your curveball instead. So he just let his changeup go to focus on the curve. So what looked like the introduction of the changeup at the major league level was actually him going back to this pitch that he'd originally had a feel for. And I think we've seen that the changeup is so crucial to his really like ace-dom level of success. So it's troubling to see him not using it. And he's not using it because he's not commanding it. Like last night, only three of his changeups were in the strike zone, which is just yikes.
Well, and it's even Ellen Moore is just not even in the strike zone. It's badly missing the strike zone. I mean, when Aaron Nola is missing, generally speaking, it's just off the corner. So a hitter doesn't know right out of the hand whether or not the pitch is going to be a strike or not. And so that's what makes Aaron Nola so dangerous. He can paint the corners and he can also paint just off the corners. And that makes it really impossible for a hitter to know when they see fastball out of his hand. Okay, well, is this going to be a pitch that I can take because it's going to be inside, or is it going to be on the corner? Do I have to switch? Swing and you get hitters up there tentative, but he hasn't been able to command anything, fastball, curveball, changeup so far this year. And it's not that he hasn't been able to even throw strikes. His first pitch strike percentage is way down this year, but it's that he's missing badly. And that's what worries me more than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the changeups that he was throwing yesterday, for example, they were mostly to lefties, but if there had been a right-hand hitter standing there, they would have hit the right hand.
Yeah.
They were that sort of far off. And I mean, the thing about his first four starts is that it's sort of, if you're just doing pitching line evaluation, it looks sort of like he's had different troubles in each one of them, like one sort of as un-Nola-esque as the next, first walking a bunch of guys and then giving up home runs. And after the first two starts, I was just like, this is strange, but his home run to fly ball rate is going to regress to the norm, which it is. It's at 27.8 right now, and that's the highest that he's ever had. I think the other one was, or the next highest was 15.1% in his first rookie half season. But in the games since then, it's been hits of all kinds that have hurt him. Even though yesterday's BABIP was pretty high, I ultimately think, I don't know, I've just talked all this way around to exactly the first thing that you said, which is like, but just that his normal command, which is normally like, you know, you could needlepoint a sampler with it, is not there. So that's going to lead to walks, like the very sad one versus Brandon Nimmo in the fourth last night, or pitches are going to land in the zone where they can be crushed. So it kind of looks like the good angel of command is not hovering at Nola's shoulder at the moment, which is the good angel that I would choose if I could choose factor, even more than the good angel of velocity. And for last night, it was so windy. You know, we saw what was done to fly balls. And we also saw like that the flag was wrapped all the way around the flagpole. So I could explain some of it. And Syndergaard certainly wasn't at his best either.
It's tough to pitch with wind gusts in the 50s and 60 mile an hour range. I mean, it just is. And we saw there was some video circulating of Syndergaard touching the palm of his glove with his two fingers. And I mean, that's almost certainly he had some pine tar on his glove so that he could grip the darn thing, because otherwise on a night like that, it's like trying to throw a pool cue. And hitters will even tell you, we don't mind. You know, you got to be subtle about it. But if a pitcher needs a little bit of pine tar so that he's not endangering our lives, especially when you throw as hard as Thor throws, Rhys Hoskins said on Tuesday afternoon that he's okay with it to a degree. But at the same time, you know, that just goes to show those were difficult conditions on Monday night. So that does make you a little bit, just give you a moment of pause. And we are still talking about a small sample size with everybody that we're analyzing. But I say that to say this, too. When we're talking about Nick Pivetta, who only managed to get through five innings in the blowout win on Tuesday, he didn't get a quality start. The offense gave him every opportunity to just kind of mow through hitters, and he wasn't able to do that. He gave up 10 base runners in those five innings, didn't look comfortable really at any time, just continuing a pattern this year where we were supposed to get breakout Nick Pivetta, and Ellen, that hasn't happened either yet. And I wonder how long you think he gets in the starting rotation. How much rope does Gabe Kapler give him to get himself on track?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, what Gabe said about it was also sort of noncommittal. As you've commented on this same show, it was kind of a departure from Gabe Kapler last year, just being Mr. Positivity at all times. And, right. You know, I think as fans, we are glad to see that return to reality. So I don't know. I mean, I feel like what we're seeing right now in this game is Jared Eichhoff being pretty good. And so that could end up being a solution. Or, you know, if Nick Pivetta needs to figure something out, I was, as much as the next person, really hoping to see in some ways I want to say the Pivetta breakout, but in some ways just Pivetta gaining some consistency. Mm-hmm. I was going to see that as much as the next person, or possibly more, or, you know, basically the fact that it seemed like he should have been having such much better results given the batted ball data on the hit that he gave up. And so it sort of seemed like, oh, this has to happen. And I think that we all came into this season being like, everybody said that it has to happen, and so it's going to happen.
Right.
You know, actually, all of our collective belief that somehow doesn't seem to have had an impact on the baseballs.
No, it's right. Nick Pivetta didn't become a superstar pitcher through osmosis, which I'm highly disappointed in, but I guess I can't be too terribly surprised because that's not how life works.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting that if this team can get their starting rotation together, they can be a playoff team, but what do you make of the National League East right now here in 2019? I mean, the Phillies have basically played everybody in the division. They have a series under their belt now, just about. There's one more game against the Mets as we're talking right now to go. But we've gotten a little bit of a look at all of the teams in the division, specifically the contenders, the Braves, the Mets, and the Nationals. How are you feeling about all four of these teams? It seems to me, Ellen, like we're going to be in a dogfight all year with these guys. It's really an evenly matched group of teams.
I think so too. I think it's going to just be a battle the whole season, and I think that every win they're just going to have to grind it out as much as they possibly can. I mean, it's so interesting. All of the projections coming in, specifically after the Phillies signed Harper, really just had them neck and neck, and even just sort of different projection systems had different people ending up at the top, which just kind of shows you that all of these teams are really within sort of spitting distance of each other.
Right. Right.
So.
No, that's true. Yeah, I mean, this division could be separated by 6 or 7 games from first to fourth place. That's really how this whole thing could go down, and that would make my son happy. My son, we live in the Northern Virginia area. I grew up in the Philly area, which is why I'm a Phillies fan, a diehard Phillies fan. But my son is 8 years old, and he adores baseball. Huge baseball fanatic. So it's a dream come true for me. I get to watch baseball with my oldest son. Hopefully, my other two sons, who are 5 and 3, will also develop the bug. But it does hurt a little bit in that he's been born and raised here in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and he's a Nationals fan. My father-in-law, his grandfather has fed him a bunch of Nationals propaganda here, Ellen, and they like to give me the bit, and he wants to root for the team that's from the town that he lives, and I can respect that, you know what I mean? But I'm curious, you know, what do you think about as a parent, you know, as me as a parent, you know, where that when I have a kid, I want to be a Phillies fan, but I'm just happy he likes baseball. How hard should I push? I'm looking for some advice here from someone to kind of give me a little bit of help as far as how to bring my son along and maybe make the transition at some point.
Well, I guess I wonder if you can make him buy the same thing that my parents suggested to me, which is just that you can, you know, cheer for multiple teams.
Yeah.
And I have to explain my lifestyle, my baseball lifestyle, to people so often that I realize that I'm giving him an uphill battle for that. But, I mean, you know, to a certain extent, I feel like your sports fandom is just can be like your political persuasion or your religious affiliation. Like, you're not always going to be doing what your parents did, but if you don't, you're doing it in relation to what they taught you. And actually, I've never thought about this before, but I wasn't really raised with a particular religion, but I was raised, my parents, it was very important to them that I understand that everybody's religions are true for them and that I respect them and that in a way they're all true. And I feel like maybe there's some like overlap with my pan baseball fan, like the way that they taught me to root for baseball, except for, I guess the analogy stops here, which is that I was raised in a fundamentalist hatred of the Yankees, as I often say.
Well, that's,
And
that should go without saying in every household.
I agree.
You were raised right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, you know, if I were to have a child, I guess I would have to say that I would let my child choose whatever team he or she wanted. Although my husband is a Mets fan. And so if she picked,
oh, boy.
I can't say that there isn't a part of me that wouldn't be just brokenhearted, but my would be that at least I could teach him or her through my example and through my husband's example, because he's perfectly happy to like root for the Phillies with me when they're not playing the Mets.
And that's how my son is too. He the Phillies are his third favorite team. Likes the Nationals and the Orioles, and the Phillies are his third. His Rocky, he's got a whole list of like, he's like you. He's got six or seven teams that he has a list. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a complex flowchart of baseball allegiances. It sounds good.
You should see. He's like a conspiracy theorist in his room. He's got pin cushions with strings connecting one team to the next. It's something. It's funny. He definitely just loves baseball, and he does root for the Phillies when they're not playing the Nationals. So I'm accepting that. That's enough for me. Although it isn't great for my brand as a Phillies podcaster and blogger, Ellen. I'm not gonna lie.
You're tolerant.
Well, yes, that's right. I just want my kid to like baseball with me, and so that works for me absolutely. And there's time. He's only 8. I real quick about baseball movies. Since you're in the movie business, you're in the movie industry, the entertainment industry. I imagine you love baseball movies like I do. And you know, I don't know that I could come up with a favorite baseball movie of mine. I love so many different baseball movies for different reasons, because some are comedies like Major League and Bull Durham, some are dramas, you know, like the Rookie and Moneyball and all these. There's just so many different kinds of baseball movies. But I wonder, like, if you could go back and pick any baseball movie that's been made, and you could be an actress in any of those movies and take any role that you wanted. It didn't even have to be, you know, a male or female role, player, manager, Kevin Costner in one of the 90 baseball movies that he was in. What movie would you most want to be in, and what role would you play?
Oh, I love this. I mean, I guess the obvious one for me is that I would want to play the Geena Davis role in A League of Their Own.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, it's sort of not even close, but I guess I had never considered if I could play a man in a baseball movie. But just, you know, I was like, when I played softball, I was a catcher. And so like growing up as a kid watching that movie, I was like, it's me.
I didn't want to limit you. I didn't want to limit you to only female characters in baseball movies. You know, I just, you know, cause we're using our imagination here. I figured you could just pick any movie that you wanted, any role that you wanted. But
yeah,
I mean, Geena Davis is a great idea. No, I mean, even if you do have the entire panorama of baseball filmdom at your feet, picking Geena Davis, I tell you what, as a guy, that'd probably be top 5 or 10 on my list too.
Yeah, and like I'd get to be married to Bill Pullman, who's like the nicest man. So
have you met Bill Pullman?
I have, yeah, nice, yeah, yeah. On The Sinner.
Oh, okay, that's right. That's, he's great actor. One of my favorite. I mean, just
he's
what a
so
terrific
good.
Actor he is. Yeah. Unbelievable. All right. So as we finish up here, Ellen, what projects are you working on right now? Is there anything you we should be on the lookout for?
Sure. Yeah. So I guest starred on The Good Fight, which is on CBS All Access, and my episode aired last week. So you can go see that right now if you so desire.
Excellent name for a TV show.
Excellent name for it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So I have this tradition that I started when I was on Homeland of taking a picture of myself in like whatever my character hair and character makeup is, but then with like one of my baseball shirts. and this was from one of the like wonderful PAs on Homeland remarked how hilarious my like intensely sort of Republican hair for my character in Homeland, how incongruous it looked with my actual wardrobe, which is usually baseball shirts. So anyway, that's how that started. So yeah, when I took the picture for The Good Fight, it was an Aaron Nola shirt because of course it was.
Well done.
So there's that. And also I just wrapped a film, playing the lead in a film that I cannot talk about yet. I can talk about it, I think, very soon, but I can't talk about it yet. So sorry. Also right now I'm working on writing a TV series with my friend Chris Carfizzi from Billions about baseball writers. And the angle,
oh, that's great,
is really about a woman fighting her way to be taken seriously in her male dominated field, that is sports writing, with her male ally best friend. So we're planning on producing a proof of concept for this summer, and it's really fun to work on.
That's a terrific idea. And I know a lot of women baseball writers, and I know the struggles. I mean, I don't know the struggles, but I hear the struggles that women sports writers go through. And that is an area that is rich for stories to be told. So hopefully that will work out, because that would be some fantastic television. And we'll have you back on later in the season, Ellen, so you can tell us about this mysterious movie that you're in, because we want to hear more about it. And we'll get your thoughts on the team, hopefully as the team's in a pennant chase here, and once the summer rolls around, and we'll hopefully talk about a baseball team that's getting ready to play some playoff baseball. But make sure that you follow Ellen on all her social media accounts. Follow her on Twitter at Ellen_Adair. Ellen, thank you so much for coming on Hit and Season. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Up next, the Phillies make a big announcement this week that surprised absolutely no one. That's up next right here on Hit and Season. And we're back on Hit and Season. Real quick, before we finish things up here this week, the Phillies made a big announcement along with city officials and MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred that the 2026 All-Star Game would be coming to Philadelphia as the city celebrates the nation's 250th birthday. The Phillies have basically been eyeing this year for a long time to bring the All-Star Game back to Philadelphia. The last time it was in Philadelphia was 1996, but we remember it more famously for being in the city in 1976 for the country's bicentennial. And the Phillies, I think, had 5 All-Stars in the game that year. That was the first year of that great 1976-83 run that team went on. And I know a lot of us had wondered why Citizens Bank Park had never hosted an All-Star game. Generally speaking, when a new park opens, they get a shot to host the All-Star game pretty soon after that as a way to feature the new ballpark. And Citizens Bank Park opened in 2004, but never hosted a Midsummer Classic. But we found out that team officials had decided to allow the park to go without an All-Star game so that they could try and basically put a bookmark in 2026, and Dave Montgomery had been working with Rob Manfred to try and work this out, and the city and the team made the announcement at a ceremony at Independence Hall, and the All-Star game is going to come to Philadelphia in 2026. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. The city's also trying to lure the Super Bowl and the World Cup to celebrate the semi-quincentennial, which is what they're going to call the 250th anniversary. And that's part of the reason why the league is making the announcement now, even though there's no site been selected for the All-Star Games in 2021 to 2025. This year's game is in Cleveland. Next year's will be played at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles. But the Phillies wanted to get this locked in now so that they could make an aggressive push to go get the Super Bowl in 2026 and to go get World Cup qualifying games in 2026. So the city of Philadelphia wants to own the year 2026, and they want to bring entertainers to the city to be at these different events, to be a part of this. And so getting this all lined up now, I know it seems kind of ridiculous that it's 7 years in the future. Bryce Harper will be, I think, on the eighth year of his 13-year contract with the Phillies when this All-Star game rolls around. But it kind of had to be put in motion now so that the city of Philadelphia and the other sports teams could try to get these other balls in the air and get this thing moving so that basically the center of the world can turn its focus on Philadelphia in 2026. And the first step in that is getting the Major League Baseball All-Star game, which the Phillies announced earlier this week. So again, the worst kept secret in sports in the city was that this leaked late last week. We all knew this was coming, but still a very cool celebration, a cool announcement by the Phillies and the city. Pennsylvania governor was there. Philadelphia mayor was there. It was a lot of dignitaries, Mike Schmidt, Bryce Harper, former players, members of the front office, Gabe Kapler, everybody was there to make the announcement. So again, another cool moment for the Phillies here in 2019. All right, it's time for your stat of the week. And of course, I have to pull a stat from that crazy 14-3 game the Phillies won on Tuesday. Steven Matz became only the ninth pitcher since 1908 to go zero innings and allow at least 8 runs, and he became the first to do it against the Phillies ever. And folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hitting Season. My thanks to Ellen Adair for coming on the podcast. If you haven't done it already, as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating and a review when you subscribe to The Good Fight at Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to check out all of the bonus content we have at the Hittin' Season Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/hittin'season. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.